Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll deal with a number of subjects in the news and obviously concentrate on the capture of Saddam Hussein. We're going live now to Iraq, and I'm speaking with Brian Bennett, who's a Time magazine correspondent in Iraq. And Brian, you had a major article in the current issue of Time, Who Are the Insurgents? Briefly, who are the insurgents? Given that Saddam Hussein, we suspected, was leading the insurgency, but it seems like a man covered in lice with a long beard living in a hole, it doesn't seem to be the kind of person that could be directing an insurgency.
That's right. And what we found after a few months of investigating the insurgency and trying to unlock some of the different elements that are going into fighting the Americans here in Iraq, what we found was that not everyone in the insurgency is a Saddam loyalist, but we did discover that most of the attacks, especially the more organized and attacks that showed good military experience, were being led by regime loyalists, people who were loyal to Saddam Hussein and wanted to see him come back to power. And that doesn't mean, however, that Saddam was sitting somewhere with a sandbox directing attacks and saying, well, you know, you go here, you go here. What he was doing, it seemed, for many of the cells that we talked to, was providing inspiration and ideological framework, and also occasionally passing down messages through intermediaries to the commanders, getting strategic guidelines for different targets to hit.
And Brian Bennett, you had access.
Go ahead.
Sorry, you had access to a former Saddam aide who's close to the insurgents in Anbar province, and he obviously gave you a lot of information. So the obvious question is, if you can talk to him, how come our military intelligence people can't?
Well, I think his main motivation for talking to a journalist was to get out what he felt was the motivation behind the resistance. Mm-hmm. And the man that the intermediary introduced me to wanted to effectively tell their story, that they wanted to fight for Saddam Hussein to come back because they felt that he was the leader who could unify Iraq, solve Iraq's security problems, and in his opinion, Saddam's excessive brutality was the only way to control the country.
So clearly, when the Secretary of Defense refers to these people as dead enders, it's much more nuanced than that.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's a certain strata of the resistance that do fall into that category. I sort of call them disaffected Iraqis. They're young men who maybe were soldiers in the army or had other jobs within the regime, who are now find themselves unemployed. You know, maybe their houses or their relative houses have been raided by the Americans, and they feel emasculated and put upon by the American occupation. And those are the guys, the sort of dead enders or disaffected Iraqis. They're the guys who are out there lobbing RPGs and grenades at American convoys, making maybe, you know, rudimentary homemade bombs to set up an attack on the side of the road against American patrols. But the more sophisticated attacks, the ones that show a certain amount of military strategy, those we found were being perpetrated by men who were either close to Saddam Hussein himself or working as high-level officials in maybe Saddam Hussein's military infrastructure or the Fedayeen Saddam, which was the militia that was designed to protect Saddam and his regime.
And clearly, those sophisticated attacks operate on very good intelligence. They targeted Paul Wolfowitz and his hotel, and they've been successful in strategically targeting people that would help the United Nations, the Italians, the Spaniards, the Japanese, And you mentioned in your article, Brian Bennett, again, I'm speaking to Brian Bennett, the Time magazine correspondent who is in Iraq and who has been had access to the insurgents and has been able to profile them. You mentioned the money trail, that they're paid as much as $1,000 for every American they kill. That in itself suggests some kind of organization, the money flow.
Certainly, and what we found out, that a lot of the foot soldiers aren't necessarily loyal to Saddam. Many of the fighters, even some of the experienced fighters, are call themselves Mujahideen and are fighting what they consider to be a holy war. However, the hierarchy and the structure of some of the resistance cells, as well as the money that came down from certain regime members at the top, the money sources for buying weapons, for maybe paying off some unemployed men to place bombs or attack U.S. convoys, the money source was definitely coming from former regime monies that had been hidden away during the chaos immediately following the war.
And you mentioned also that the bomb in Nasiriyah that killed the Italians, 31 people died in that, came from a munitions dump that the U.S. forces had disabled the missile, but apparently they left behind the 2,000-pound warhead, and that was the warhead that was used in the bombing of the Italians. So that seems a little sloppy, doesn't it?
One cell claimed that they had formed this operation, and that is how they described it to me. A U.S. intelligence official confirmed that was possible, that happened, and that was the scenario of how the bomb was manufactured. But I couldn't get a U.S. official to confirm that was in fact the way that the attack went off, and that was the material that was used in the bomb. But the fact that the cell would claim and sort of give this very detailed description of how they went into an unguarded ammunition dump where a lot of the rockets had been disabled by the Americans. They were disabled, as far as their explosive material is concerned, but only disabled as far as projecting them at aircraft or projecting them at other long-range surface targets. Mm.
And you also, in your article, Brian Bennett, you mentioned that the insurgents that you interviewed don't operate in their own towns, that if they do an operation in Baghdad, they tend to come from Fallujah or somewhere else. What is the logic behind that?
Well, there was one interesting development that we found in doing this investigation, was that in just the last maybe 2-3 months, the resistance cells were able to get together and share intelligence. Their leaders were able to meet on a regular basis.
Hello? I'm afraid we lost our connection to Iraq, to Baghdad, with the Time magazine correspondent who wrote the article in the current issue, Who Are the Insurgents? And Brian Bennett of Time magazine had unusual access to the very people who are killing the United States soldiers and civilians. And I was just hoping to do the final question to him, which was about his own personal danger in Iraq, given that this week a fellow correspondent with Time magazine had his hand blown off by a grenade that was tossed into a Humvee that he was traveling in with the famous war correspondent, photographer, James Natchway, and a couple of other American soldiers whose lives effectively were saved by the Time magazine correspondent's actions in tossing the grenade out. And, of course, in doing so, he was injured and had his hand blown off. So, but it's obviously difficult to get through to Iraq, and I'm grateful that we had some time with Brian Bennett, whose article, Who Are the Insurgents?, is in the current issue of Time magazine. Time magazine have had to pull their current issue in an unusual move to change the cover and to put on the picture of a haggard Saddam Hussein with a long beard. Apparently, he was also covered in lice. Again, it's hardly possible that this pathetic individual is this monster fiendishly directing these incredibly fiendishly efficient attacks that the insurgents perpetrate. Let's move on, and we'll go to London now with Tariq Ali, who is the author of a new book, Bush in Babylon, the Recolonization of Iraq. And Tariq Ali, clearly there's a great deal of jubilation both here in the White House and in the press, and indeed at the press conference that Paul Bremer conducted in Baghdad, where he announced the capture of Saddam Hussein. He began the press conference by saying, "We got him," and there was a rousing cheer from the reporters. So people are obviously happy to have gotten him. What's the sense in England? Because I believe President Bush, among the many calls he made to Middle Eastern leaders, he also called, I think the first call he made was to Tony Blair.
Well, I've in fact been in Germany all day. I've just got back here. But in Germany, which is the single most important country in Europe, the mood was, you know, perfectly normal. People, when informed, I was at a big conference with Chancellor Schroeder's chief foreign policy advisor discussing the situation in the Middle East. When news came through, we discussed it. And I think the general agreement was that it's not going to help the United States except as propaganda. The resistance goes on. This old man crouching in a tiny hole in a village where he was beaten up as a boy, capturing him because someone gave his hideout away, probably under torture.
But he possibly for the $30 million price tag.
Possibly for money. Who knows how they got it? But fine, so they've got Saddam, and according to their own logic, they said Saddam was leading the resistance. It should now cease. But I don't think that's going to happen. In fact, an article I wrote in The Guardian here some weeks ago, I said even if they capture Saddam or he drops dead, the resistance is going to go on. And curiously enough, you might now see over the next few weeks more people joining the resistance now that they're sure Saddam is not going to come back. What we must dissociate is any notion that those people in Iraq who don't like Saddam Hussein are in favor of the occupation of their country. The overwhelming majority of Iraqis are against that occupation. And if the Americans were now to say, we've got Saddam and we're taking him back to the United States and we're leaving your country and going with him because he was the source of all evil, which is what they've been saying, Iraqis would really, this time, they would wave them off and, you know, give them whatever they want, flowers, honey, whatever, saying, go, go, go. But I don't think that's been the aim of the occupation. So the point I'm making is, obviously, the capture of Saddam is a propaganda coup. For Bush, it should help in the re-election campaign, the trial, etc. But in terms of what actually exists on the ground in Iraq, what difference is it going to make in terms of the resistance? I think it will accelerate the resistance in the medium term.
Do you think, I take it, that, Tariq Ali, that you suspect that Saddam Hussein may go on trial. Would it surprise you that he went on trial in October, perhaps, a month before the election?
Or September. That might be more subtle.
Right. Well, marginal. So.
The thing is, the risk of putting Saddam on trial is that he would probably start naming names of all the Americans he's worked with, right up to Donald Rumsfeld. He could talk about how the CIA used to help him hunt communists in Iraq and supply him with lists of people they wanted rubbed out. He could talk of how during the Iran-Iraq war he was regularly in touch with senior people in Washington and London who were arming him. All this could come out. Do they want this to come out before the elections? I don't know. Maybe they do. Maybe they don't care. But a lot of dirt could come out involving some senior Republicans.
Do you think that they'll offer him a deal, though, since they've claimed that he's either in charge of the insurrection, which is clearly bogus, or the inspiration for the insurrection that may have some truth to it? Could they make a deal with him whereby he encourages his followers to give up the insurgency in exchange for his life?
They could try, but even if he does, the fact is, as I've been stressing, since the occupation of Iraq. There are Ba'athist party people who are part of the insurgency, but there are lots and lots of non-Ba'athists as well. And also, you've got to understand that the Ba'ath Party did have an anti-Saddam wing, which was scared, intimidated. Some of its leaders had been killed. Now that Saddam has been captured, they will probably come back and take the leadership of their old party away. And so it's unpredictable. And it's very noticeable that even though Bremer was triumphalist, Lieutenant General Sanchez was not. He said, "I wouldn't, you know, go in for any ideas that the resistance is going to come to a quick end."
Sanchez actually, you know, he goes to the press conferences sporting a sidearm, so he's clearly sending a signal that he doesn't consider the country very secure.
No, exactly.
But Tariq Ali, again, you mentioned that you just returned to London from a conference in Germany where you met with foreign ministry officials in Germany. You know, James Baker has been appointed by George Bush, you know, for sort of adult supervision. He's the man who, after all, got him elected by the shenanigans in Florida. And apparently the neoconservatives here tried to sabotage Baker's trip by Wolfowitz putting up on the Pentagon website that they weren't going to give any contracts out to Germany and France and Russia and those that opposed this war.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, they're sending Baker over there to ask Germany to forgive its debts to Iraq. So what was the mood amongst the German foreign ministry officials?
Well, I didn't meet an official. I just want to make that clear. I met a person who is a senior advisor to Chancellor Schroeder. So he's not from the Foreign Office. He's a Social Democrat. Basically, people are, you know, quite cynical about the whole operation, and they're not totally surprised that the United States is not giving sharing part of the loot with those who didn't participate in the war. You know, I mean, they're quite cynical in Europe. They know that what the United States is up to. I mean, there's the old saying, to the victors, the spoils. And that is essentially what is going on.
But what spoils are we talking about here, Tariq Ali? I mean, the place is a mess. You can't even get the oil if they want it.
No, exactly. And they got their big corporations in to reconstruct. I mean, as you know, Halliburton has been overcharging the government on fuel sent to Iraq from Kuwait. And it's open house. For looting this country. All its state facilities have been bombed and shelled. Now they have to be reconstructed. But Iraq, which had one of the best free health services in the region, is now going to have a privatized health service, courtesy of Abt Associates, an American company which specializes in privatizations in these countries. And one of the first things these companies' officials have asked for is armored cars. So that says it all.
Mm. Well, you know, there are 40 million uninsured in this country. So you extrapolate that out. The Iraqis are really heading for the same kind of disastrous health care that the United States have. And as you mentioned, they did have you know, before Saddam took over, Iraq had a GDP greater than Portugal.
Exactly.
So there's a potential for this country to... but the thing that I keep hearing consistently is that every time you talk to an Iraqi, they say all this stuff about the Shia versus the Sunni versus the Kurds is nonsense, that there is a national identity.
There is,
and that, yeah. That the American occupation is just to have this arrogant colonial attitude that the WOGs aren't capable of governing themselves.
Well, I know, exactly. This has been, you know, anyone who knows Iraq knows this. So it's, you know, to look at Iraqis through their ethnic or religious identities is crazy. No one in Iraq does that. I mean, the southern part of Iraq, which is predominantly Shia, is also the poorest part of the country. The Ba'ath Party had Shia members. The Communist Party had Shia members. I mean, you know, it's foolish to talk like this. What is true is that for the last 12 years, the West has been pouring money into some of the Shiite organizations to help them against Saddam, and they'll now pay the price for that.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with Tariq Ali, the author of Bush in Babylon, the recolonization of Iraq. And it seems to me that there's always been a disconnect here, Tariq Ali. There are two audiences that the Bush administration operate for. One is the American audience, which is their primary audience, and then the second one is the Iraqi audience. And it seems from the very beginning that what pleases the American audience invariably displeases the Iraqis, or actually hurts in the reconstruction. For example, the great shock and awe that we saw on television, that was entirely for domestic consumption here. Everybody in America thought, wow, you know, we're really getting our money's worth out of the billions we spent on the Pentagon. Most of that damage actually hurt in the reconstruction, you know, particularly with infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
And blowing up a bunch of palaces was just sort of petulant and pointless. So, again, it seems to me that the way that this capture of Saddam is going to be played over here and celebrated, and clearly to the benefit of the White House, essentially is for American domestic consumption. It doesn't really have much to do with the reality in Iraq.
I think that's absolutely true. There are two audiences. When the audiences get linked up is when the Iraqi resistance has scored a number of important hits. That's when they have to talk to a global and a domestic audience at the same time. I mean, that's why the resistance has been a big shock for them and has opened up discussion to a certain extent in the United States. I mean, some of the coverage we've been seeing in Time magazine and Newsweek and the New York Times reflects this, actually. There was a report in the New York Times a few days ago on the 7th, a front-page report by Dexter Filkins, which described how the occupying armies in Iraq had barbed-wired a whole village and what life in this village was like under occupation. And this description could have applied to almost any colonial situation over the last 100 years. There was nothing different. And so we are beginning to get this stuff out. And the key question now, of course, is whether the resistance, whether it'll be accelerated, whether they'll build up a political front organization and carry on. And once that happens, then the temporary joy they've got from Saddam's capture will disappear.
Well, it's we started out with a live call to Baghdad in Iraq with the Time magazine correspondent Brian Bennett, who did mm-hmm. an article, Who Are the Insurgents? And he actually had access to a number of the insurgents
mm-hmm.
via a former Saddam aide. And he made it clear that they're increasingly sophisticated, that they're not the so-called dead-enders.
Exactly. He's writing a report in next week's magazine, I assume.
No, well, he will, but this is in the current issue.
Oh, right.
They had to pull the run on the magazine to change the cover.
Put Saddam on.
Yes. So. In any case, I thank you very much for joining us at the last minute, Tariq Ali.
Very good.
And
nice
we'll stay in touch. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Tariq Ali, who is the author of Bush in Babylon, The Recolonization of Iraq. And we began with Time magazine's correspondent, Brian Bennett, who is in Iraq and who was the author of an article in the current issue, Who Are the Insurgents? He had access to the insurgents and profiled them in the current issue. I'm now speaking with Yusuf Ibrahim, who is the Managing Director of Strategic Energy Investment Group in out of Dubai in the Gulf. He is a consultant who does risk analysis and has spent the last 4 months in the region, just got back this week. And, of course, Yusuf Ibrahim was a 25-year veteran Middle East correspondent with The New York Times and The Wall Street Journal. And, Yusuf, do you believe that there are two audiences here in the in terms of the way Iraq is reported and disseminated, that there's the American audience and the Iraqi audience, and that perhaps while the American audience is celebrating the capture of Saddam, it may not really resonate, or it probably will resonate, but it may not make a great deal of difference in terms of facts on the ground and life on the ground.
No, I don't think there are too many Iraqis who are particularly saddened by the capture of Saddam, and in fact, perhaps many who are relieved. I would say actually the two audiences would be the Arab world versus the Iraqis. There are many people in the Arab world who just as it happens, the day Baghdad fell in a day was out of fight, who seem to experience some withdrawal symptoms. And the thing here is that they expected somehow the United States to win, of course, but to get a black eye out of it. And that same audience in the Arab world, reflecting deep dissatisfaction with the United States, may have been taken aback today by the way Saddam was captured, and in fact he looked pretty much like a homeless person. But this is a blip. It is the news of the day, and it shall pass. The bigger issue is the success of the American venture in Iraq, and we are not there yet. I was very pleased to see that the president today did not display any of the swagger and the arrogance that he displayed earlier on the aircraft carrier, and when he said, "Let's bring them on," and that his speech was modest, and that's the right tone. That's perhaps a good beginning.
Well, indeed, from reports from Baghdad indicate that there's a lot of triumphal shooting in the air, and that people apparently are discouraged from going out, at least without a helmet, because of the bullets raining down. It's kind of like New Year's Day here in Los Angeles, or New Year's Eve.
The Iraqis have nothing to thank Saddam for, at least not the majority of them. So it was a brutal regime. The fact that he is finally gone is a relief. I mean, I don't think too many people really would disagree on that.
But what about the possibility of two questions? One, putting him on trial, whether we'll have a kind of show trial that may help in the re-election of President Bush, and two, whether the United States could make a deal with Saddam if. As they believe he's in charge of the insurgency, which seems unlikely that he could direct an insurgency from a hole in the ground. But that aside, do you believe that there's a possibility of a deal where Saddam's life is spared in exchange for him calling off the insurgency?
I doubt this, Ian. This is a man who has been fighting and who actually made his first attempted assassination at age 17. Now, we saw him under extreme circumstances. He did look completely disheveled and totally disoriented. But don't forget, this is a fighter. And in two or three days, when he has recomposed himself, I don't think the Americans will find him very cooperative. So I do not think he will volunteer any amount of information. And I think the manner in which we put him on trial is going to be watched very carefully. Here you are beginning to enter into elements of humiliation, Arab dignity, and these are issues the American Army has learned a lot about in the last 3 months or 4 months of occupation. I have no doubt in my mind he should be put on trial in Iraq because he has committed many criminal offenses in Iraq. But the process has to appear to be legal and fair. I also have very little doubt, given the dimensions of the crimes he has committed, that he will get the death sentence.
And what about the notion that he could, do some reverse blackmail in terms of dealings that he had with the U.S. during the Iran-Iraq war? Do you think that he's got anything up his sleeve that he can use?
Well, it's not a big secret, Ian. We know very well that we had a team of 60 CIA agents during the Iraq
non-war helping the Iraqis, that we gave them satellite maps, that we helped them, that we gave them weapons, and that, in fact, we bombed the Iranian Navy on their behalf and destroyed Iranian oil, offshore oil platforms. So how much could he tell us that we really do not know? We dealt with Saddam Hussein. Dick Cheney dealt with Saddam Hussein and helped him and was one of his supporters. So that's sort of
Don Rumsfeld, was sent over there.
And Donald Rumsfeld. So, I mean, yeah. Okay, we know all of that stuff. He may flush it out in an open trial, but I think Saddam Hussein would use an open trial if he has the chance to speak, to make more of these the broad denunciations of imperialism and to attempt to tie himself to Islam. And he will appeal to the hostility that continues to surround the United States policy in the region, particularly in Palestine and of course, the occupation of Iraq. In that sense, that's the only chance he has. Now, that's in the context of a fair trial, a trial that where he is allowed to speak. If the trial turns into a joke or a sham, it would reflect badly, not so much on the Iraqi provisional authority, but it would reflect badly on the American occupation troops. So the manner in which he is going to be questioned, the manner in which his legal status is going to be settled, and the manner in which he is going to be tried is important. But beyond all of this, you've asked the question in the beginning. He was not running the resistance. He has not run the resistance in a long time. In fact, he's been on the run, and that resistance is now a conglomerate of groups that includes Islamists coming from outside the country, Iraqis from within the well-trained Iraqi army that was dismissed, plus some remnants of the regime, but they're only a wing of it. And I suspect that resistance will continue.
And if he's the manner in which he was captured compared to the manner in which his two sons went down fighting, How do you think that plays with the Iraqis? I mean, we are told that there's still a residual fear of the Ba'athists coming back and Saddam coming back, and that at least the occupying authorities, the provisional authority, keep saying that that's one of the reasons why we can't jumpstart Iraq and get it back together again, is because the people want an absolute guarantee that he's not coming back. So do you really believe that that's what's causing this this quagmire and this inability to bring Iraq up to the very standards that they had before this war?
I never believed this, Ian. From the very first day the Iraqi army collapsed and abandoned Saddam, Saddam Hussein is finished. The Ba'athist regime in Iran is finished. The same way Hitler was finished and the Nazi regime was finished. This is over. It will never come back again. And it's a convenient and not very good way to use this as a hanger to put on all the problems that we might have in the future upon. Ba'athism is not coming back. What we have in Iraq are new friends and also new enemies. And we have released a genie out of the bottle, and this genie has to be dealt with in the context of building a civil society. That is nation building. And nation building in a place like Iraq is a very complicated matter. And it is not something that we can do before July. And I think this issue will be with us during the election of 2004, and depending how we handle it from now to 2004, it will reflect on the chances of President Bush being elected or not being elected. But this is not the end of the road. This is just, it was fully expected that Saddam Hussein will be caught. I fully expect that Osama bin Laden will be caught, but I don't expect that the Al-Qaeda will stop its act of terror after he is caught.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may. I'm speaking with Yusuf Ibrahim, who's a 25-year veteran reporter in the Middle East for the New York Times, and he's just returned from the Middle East after 4 months in the area, where he's the managing director of Strategic Energy Investment Group out of Dubai. And there's two questions, obviously, that I'd like to ask you about the oil business and the dimension of oil vis-a-vis Iraq. A lot of critics of this invasion and occupation say it's all about oil, but there's not much evidence that they're getting much oil out of there. I've always understood that Iraq has been the odd man out in terms of this. They say the Seven Sisters and the Saudis and the traditional arrangements that the Western oil giants have in that region, and that they haven't really put it back on the market. And after all, how long has Iraq's oil been off the market? And remember, it's the second largest known deposits in the world.
That's true. And it is, in fact, ironic that given that they have the second largest oil reserves after Saudi Arabia in the world, we are now selling them gasoline, and we will be selling them fuel oil. And they're not producing it because their refineries have been destroyed and they have not yet been fixed. And, you're aware of the Halliburton scandal in which we are, in fact, selling them gasoline at twice the price we're selling gasoline in this country. So we're selling gasoline to a country that has plenty of oil. And Kuwait, and it's coming from Kuwait, it's coming from Iran, it's coming from other places. And the reason we're doing this is that not only their refineries are not up and working, but their production of oil is also not anywhere near where it should have been, where many people predicted it would be at this time. Remember, Ian, before the American invasion and occupation of Iraq, the Iraqis were producing approximately 3 million barrels of oil every day. Of that, they refined at home about 500,000 barrels, from which they produced all the gasoline. You could load a whole GMC for the equivalent of 5 cents in Iraq. Now, today, they got to pay $2 some for a gallon. You can imagine many Iraqis are very unhappy. Why is the oil production lagging? And all they're producing now is an average, a daily average, of between 1.5 to 2 million barrels a day. And depends on whether they have a good day or a bad day. A good day is a day when nobody bombs a pipeline. A bad day is a day when somebody bombs a pipeline. The pipeline that carries oil from the north of Iraq Turkey has been bombed 28 times and it's not functional. So the only place from which the Iraqis can now pump oil is the south of Iraq, on the Persian Gulf. And that too is the subject of sabotage. All things considered, the Iraqis this year, by the end of this year, will get a total revenue of $13 billion from their oil exports. Compare this to the fact that they owe the rest of the world at least $200 billion in debt. So the service on this debt alone could not be done with their oil income, let alone buying food and so on and so forth. So basically, our expectations that Iraq could repay for its reconstruction with its oil exports are, to put it mildly, at this point, far in the future.
But just to touch further on the point that you made about the Halliburton scandal, how it's been revealed that Halliburton have been overcharging for gasoline that comes out of Kuwait, and this is, after all, U.S. taxpayer money that they are overcharging the taxpayer for their services. And President Bush had to make a statement about it, and of course it's obviously embarrassing to him since his vice president was the head of the company that's being charged with price gouging and essentially ripping off the taxpayer. Now, I understand that the Halliburton or Kellogg Brown, their subsidiary, have blamed this overcharging on a Kuwaiti distributor.
Well, the president astonished me actually the other day when he actually said, yes, we believe we have been overcharged and we intend to get the money back. So he was not ambiguous about that. And Halliburton turned around and blamed it on the Kuwaitis. Now, let's look at the bigger picture of this. When I was in Iraq, people tell me, look, we have all this money that you are going to give us to rebuild the country. Why don't you create a bank that's supervised by the World Bank and the IMF and allow the very industrious, indeed, Iraqi middle class and business class easy loans to rebuild our industries? I mean, small industries. Let us just pump some blood into this class which has been totally emasculated by Saddam Hussein and his crooks. And that's how you build a business class. That's how you build a middle class. That's how you build a stake. Instead, we are giving money now to people who are basically pirates. I sit in Dubai and I see a Filipino guy coming in, sending in 350 Filipino workers to build latrines for an American army base. Why is the American army paying a Filipino instead of paying an Iraqi to build latrines for the army base? Reason is security. Perhaps they're afraid. They don't want any Muslim workers in there. They prefer Filipinos. But the point is, it defeats the purpose. The purpose is to win the trust of the Iraqis and to create within Iraq the mechanism for rebuilding the country. And the way to do it is, instead of distributing the money to the Halliburtons and the Kuwaitis, who have anyway a revenge thing against Iraq, just give it to the Iraqis. Give it at the concessionary terms and help them along.
Well, Yusuf Ibrahim, I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles today.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters. Now, just speaking then with Yusuf Ibrahim, who's a 25-year veteran reporter for the New York Times. He's just returned from the Gulf, where he spent the last 4 months, where he is the managing director of Strategic Energy Investment Group out of Dubai. And we were talking about the capture of Saddam Hussein and the oil component to this story. And we started out with Brian Bennett from the Time magazine correspondent in Iraq, who we spoke to live from Baghdad. And he'd written an article, Who Are the Insurgents? He was describing who these insurgents are. And clearly they are not being directed, or at least it's highly unlikely they are being directed by Saddam Hussein, who was found in a cave covered in lice and sporting a haggard beard. We also then heard from Tariq Ali in London, who's the author of Bush in Babylon, The Reconstruction of Iraq. I'm now speaking with Joshua Marshall, who is the author of the Weblob Talking Points Memo, and he's a contributing writer for The Washington Monthly. And you've been writing a lot about the war within the war, in terms of the war, the bureaucratic wars in Washington, as the Paul Wolfowitz group, commonly referred to as the neoconservatives, struggle for power over the president in terms of his more mainstream Republicans, people like represented by James Baker, who was just appointed by President Bush to go around the world and to try and get the Germans and the French and the Russians to forgive some of their extraordinary, enormous Iraq debt. And at the same time that one part of the administration is trying to be nice to Germany, France, and Russia, the other part of the administration out of the Pentagon, had a rather blunt and somewhat inflammatory message or email on their website, say by Paul Wolfowitz, saying there's no way that we're going to give these people who didn't support the war any contracts, so maybe they'll get lucky with a subcontract. So what do you make about this war within a war?
Well, you know, this has been, going back to your introduction, I mean, the neoconservatives have really been, you know, running the show, not exclusively, but close to it for most of the last year, even going back to the entire period after 9/11. The appointment of James Baker is, I think, fairly significant, both in substance and also there's a symbolic significance to it, because James Baker is not from the neoconservative community, from that the hawks that are around the administration. He is really really reviled by them. He is, and you have to pardon me, I have a bit of a cold, so I may start coughing all of a sudden. Anyway.
No, he's reviled by them because, you know, Wolf Aware, I mean, Pearl in particular, who's kind of the sort of intellectual godfather of the neocons, you know, he worked for Netanyahu, as did Doug Feith and the others. And the Likud party, particularly Shamir, the former leader, Shamir actually accused Baker, James Baker, of being an anti-Semite.
Yeah, well, this goes back, obviously, into James Baker had various posts going back into the Reagan and Bush administrations. He was the Secretary of State under the first President Bush, and he is seen as the, you know, he is the representative of sort of old line realist Republican foreign policy, not particularly ideological, much more attuned to, as they would see it, you know, narrowly construed American interests, expanding the way for American business and so forth. So when Baker was appointed, that was seen as, and you have to bear in mind also that James Baker is very close to the president's father. This was seen as the perhaps the president's father or the people around him bringing in Baker to basically clean up the mess that the neoconservatives or just the hawks that have been running this war that they've created. So there's a real tug of war there, and I think this dust up over the contracts is the first example of it. Now, I think it's worth saying that the administration had signaled that we would probably restrict the bidding of these contracts to countries that had supported the war. At least they had given some sense of that. But the way that it was it was done in such a public way, I mean, obviously you could just sort of not get into it on the front end, and then, you know, American countries and British companies and, you know, whoever would get the contracts, and that would be it. But how frontally it was done, I don't think there's any question, was the first bit of tug of war over this, you know, the struggle between these two camps of the administration. And at the moment, it's almost not even that there's a camp. It's really just Baker, because the State Department has been so emasculated, really, Powell particularly, that it's really the architects of the war versus James Baker, who's being brought in to, in essence, clean up the mess.
So in effect, what Wolfowitz did by putting that statement out on the Pentagon website, he's just creating facts on the ground. This is what distinguishes them from the more pragmatic centrist people in this administration. These guys are activists, and they know how to create facts on the ground. I mean, you could argue that the war in Iraq is a fact on the ground that they created.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think there's no question about that. That one of their the main ways that they operate is to, as you say, creating facts on the ground. I mean, one of the reasons I think that there was such a rush to get into, I've always thought at least, that there was such a rush to get into Iraq was that they were, and when I say they, I mean the Iraq hawks in the administration, were always afraid that the people around Powell, you know, the more centrist, pragmatic types of the administration, would basically steal the policy away from them. That if they didn't get in, that Powell, et cetera, would somehow hoodwink them and it would never come to pass. And they knew that once America was occupying Iraq, as you say, at that point there are just facts on the ground that the whole debate going in, and this is true in a sense, would just become irrelevant, because now you're there, you're on the ground, you're the occupying power, you're not in a position just to up and leave. You at a minimum have to stand up some sort of successor government and so forth. So yeah, much of what they are, these are very adept bureaucratic players in the way that Washington operates, and that is a source of their power.
Yeah, but aren't they just totally smoking Condoleezza Rice? I mean, she's basically an amateur who's quite academic and not very experienced. And
she has been, and this is still not widely reported. I think that people across the ideological spectrum just think that she's been a great disappointment. You know, what the National Security Advisor is supposed to do is to ride herd over disputes with, you know, between the different branches at the administration. And quite apart from the policies that the people in the Pentagon have wanted to pursue, one of the causes of problems this administration has had is that often they're pursuing two or three different policies simultaneously. So it's not just a matter of the Pentagon, the civilians of the Pentagon wanting to pursue this or that policy. Often you have them pursuing their policy, you have the State Department pursuing its policy, and so you just get a jumble. And again, that is what the National Security Advisor is supposed to deal with, and as you say, I think she's been a great disappointment. Not just pretty much to everybody across the spectrum. Everybody realized that she's done a very poor job.
And of course, her primary job is to protect the president.
Depending on how you want to.
Well, there's nobody else there that can actually do that. I mean,
sure. I mean, you know, she has. There's different, you know, the National Security Council is sort of an odd beast, and different National Security Advisors have taken the job differently. I mean, I think that, you know, often all foreign policy, I mean, there's at least been some administrations where foreign policy has really run out of the National Security Council. I think that
this one looks like it's being run out of the Pentagon.
Well, I think in this case, it's pretty. I mean, with some exceptions, it has been. I think the way that Rice has seen her job is to be much more the president's national security advisor, in the sense of the one who that is kind of the focus of her job, being the one who you know gives sort of bounces. You know that the president can bounce ideas off, almost in political terms. The president's body person on foreign policy, i.e. the person who's kind of always with him, answers questions for him, stuff like that, where I think in most cases in the last half century, the person who has that job, what they're supposed to do is much more of an administrative role, make sure the State Department and the Defense Department and everybody else is on the same page and all moving in the same direction.
Well, just in the last few minutes, Josh Marshall, again, Josh Marshall is the author of the weblog, Talking Points Memo, and he's a contributing writer for the Washington Monthly and one of the more informed Washington insiders. And just in the last minute, Josh Marshall, how is this capture of Saddam Hussein going to play within the wars within this administration, the war within the war? Who's going to benefit most? Will it be the neocons or the more pragmatic ones like Powell?
Good question. It certainly will give it'll certainly give a boost to the president, and I would say I think in the short term it'll give a boost to the architects of the war, since they are the ones who this is, you know. This is seen as positive for the overall war policy, and that's the neocons, the people of the Pentagon. So in the short term, I think it'll be a boost for them. I don't think, though, that in the medium term or long term, it will really be that important for the way that those sort of intramural wars inside the administration are playing out.
So the president is one of our earlier guests mentioned that he thought the president actually was quite subdued. He wasn't sort of cocky and triumphal like he was on the aircraft carrier. And when he made that outrageous challenge to the insurgents to bring it on, that he was actually quite sober. And that would indicate that perhaps he doesn't believe that the capture of Saddam is going to end the insurgency.
You know, I don't think anybody who's really paying attention to this thinks that this is going to end the insurgency, that it's going to, you know, wrap up all the difficulties the U.S. is having in the country. I think that they think that, you know, perhaps they can use this to build some sort of consensus, some sort of reconciliation among Iraqis. I'm not sure that's true, but I think that that was behind that the tone that the president took.
Well, thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Josh Marshall. I hope you feel better.
And very well too.
There's a great deal of triumphalism now on television and radio. So, you know, and even in the press conference that when the provisional authority head Paul Bremer announced it, his first line was "We got him," and it was great spontaneous cheer. So, so the journalistic world is definitely being the cheer squads for the in this particular instance.
Yeah, no question, no question.
And I thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, here speaking with Josh Marshall, who's the author of the weblog, Talking Points Memo, and he's also a contributing writer to the Washington Monthly. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I thank Mark Maxwell, the engineer, and I thank Louis Vandenberg for research and production on this program. We had an entirely different program, actually, lined up for you today, but we'll save some of those people for next week.